We're back at Fictional Frontiers. It's James Berardinelli time on Fictional Frontiers. James is the founder of RealViews.net. He's the best online film critic in America. And this is a Real Take segment with us. And James, it's funny, just a couple minutes ago before we hopped on the call, we typically talk about what we're going to talk about during the segment. We have very little time, so we just jumped right in, right? There's no planning. There's kind of an extemporaneous approach to this week's show. And I think it's kind of par for the course with where we are with respect to not just the country as a whole, but the theater exhibition industry, as we've seen it kind of spiral out of control and sadly, in many respects, come to an end. I want to start with some really sad news for me personally. I don't know why it impacted me so much, but regionally, we had a theater called the AMC Hamilton 24. And for me, it was kind of the go-to theater because it wasn't too far from my house. It was about, you know, 30-minute drive from where I live. It was a megaplex. It had the IMAX screen. And once in a while, it had, you know, screenings held there. And I remember about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago when Kong Skull Island came out, my brother and my dad came in from Virginia. They were attending a medical conference, continuing medical education conference, excuse me. And they had never gone to a press screening. And I actually invited them to come along as my plus twos. And I remember my dad being so excited. He's a movie buff, and typically he's pretty straight edge. He doesn't really get excited about many things. But I remember he had this giddy look on his face, and he actually met you at the screening. And
I do remember that.
So I have fond memories of that theater, not just because of that, but because of some other screenings there. So when I heard the news, actually just a couple days ago, that they were closing the theater permanently, it was really shocking. I know we've talked about this in principle. We've talked about the logistics of what could happen over the next couple of months, and you know, with COVID, even sooner than that. But to actually see one of the theaters that literally was just open, you know, 8 months ago, doing relatively well, just close its doors permanently, that was a shock to the system. What did you feel like when you saw that? I mean, were you surprised? Were you crestfallen a little bit? What was your sense?
You know, like you, I've attended that theater quite often. I attended it maybe even longer than you did.
Yeah, I think so.
The interesting thing about that is when I used to live in central New Jersey, that theater, which was, you know, located just south of Princeton, happened to be sort of, you know, it was about 45 minutes away from where I lived, but it was by far the biggest multiplex within sort of the sphere of, and that was in an era when I would actually drive farther than I do now to go to see a movie. Now, if I have to drive more than 10 minutes, it's too far. That was in a time, you know, when I was much more liberal about where I went. So I actually would drive down to the Hamilton Theater, you know, not that often, but certainly, you know, a few times a year. And then when I moved to my, you know, current location, it was about the same distance away from where I am now that it was where I previously lived. So I, you know, old habits die hard. I continued to sometimes go to that theater. But I associated with it, I associated the theater intimately with a particular film critic. You know, you knew him as well, you know, Cam.
Yes, yes.
And he died 2 years ago. But that had always been his stomping grounds, and he was based out of Princeton, and he was a well enough known film critic that he could essentially get screenings, press screenings, scheduled at that theater. After he died, there were no more press screenings there anymore. I tried to get a few there, but I didn't have the same kind of pull that he had. Much great blow to my ego that was. But the theater had a couple of, you know, it was actually, they did a pretty big remastering of it. I think it was last year.
Yeah,
where they added the Dolby Theater there. And they made some major changes to the IMAX to make it IMAX Laser, I think is what they called
yeah,
it.
Yeah, IMAX Laser.
And that was also one of the theaters, or rare theaters around here, that had a 75-millimeter projection system.
Mm.
So it was still capable of showing 75-millimeter.
I didn't know that.
Or 70-millimeter films. 70 millimeter.
COVID age, everything's getting to us. But no, I get what you're saying. Yeah, 70 millimeter.
We haven't talked about, you know, millimeters in association with films for so long.
Yeah.
But I was not aware that it had closed until I heard it from you, and I did a little bit of digging, and apparently it's sort of a combination of two things. One was that AMC, which owned the theater, and as part of their overall debt reduction strategy, they had to refinance the deals that they had with their landlords. And one particular landlord owned many of the properties on which AMC theaters are built, including the one in Hamilton. And as part of the restructuring deal, AMC, or this landlord, was able to foreclose on six or seven of the properties nationally. Now, they didn't just do this without consultation with AMC. They didn't just decide, well, we want these six properties, so we're going to foreclose on them. AMC looked at theaters that had suffered the biggest drops in attendance as a result of COVID, and Hamilton was one of the, I think it was number three in the country.
Wow.
Not counting New York and, you know, places that haven't reopened. But of the theaters that reopened in, I guess it was end of August, Hamilton had suffered over a 90% drop in attendance.
Mm.
And that put it on AMC's hit list. And so they talked to the real estate guys, and they foreclosed on Hamilton.
Wow.
And so, you know, the theater closed. Now, what, you know, people are wondering, or people, I guess, you know, in the Hamilton area are hoping that it'll be taken over by some other theater, that's not going to happen.
Well, let me add.
It is a beautiful theater, but right now, nobody's going to take over that lease, which is essentially what they would have to do. Now, granted, if theaters were doing well now, that would be an extremely attractive property.
Right.
But theaters are not making any money now. No independent, nobody's got the money to take over that theater with its operating expenses and the lease involved. And
also the location as well. I just wanted to add that again, for those of our listeners who aren't from this area, when James says it's a prime area, it's a wonderful theater, it's a beautiful theater, the location is amazingly convenient as well. You just take this one highway, 295, and you get off of exit, I think, 65B. There's actually a transit station on that same exit, and it's literally off the ramp. You can see the theater from the highway. So it's one of the most convenient theaters in the entire Delaware Valley, I think, you could get to. Wouldn't you agree, James? It's probably one of the most, if not the most.
Yeah, I mean, I know people from Philadelphia who preferred to go to that theater than go to King of Prussia at times. It's actually really easy to get to from Philadelphia, too, because you can just take what used to be 95 North, now it's 295 East, up to the Scudder Falls Bridge, cross over, and it's not that far. It's only about 12 miles into New Jersey from there.
Right.
So it's a very, you know, it's a bit of a hike, but it's a very straightforward trip.
Mm-hmm. And parking is not an issue at all at that theater.
No, it had a huge parking lot. The problem is it's big. I mean, it's a big theater. It's a 24-plex, and that ultimately was part of its downfall. As I've said before, the bigger ones are going to be the first ones to go.
You were right. Mm-hmm.
Because you said, looking beyond this pandemic, you know, you look at the theatrical landscape on the other side, and it does not favor big theaters. It favors small theaters, actually. you know, if you go back to the 1990s, 80s and 90s, the big thing was to take these large single theaters and twins in many cases and subdivide them. You had a lot of single theaters that became twins or triplexes, and you had a lot of like triplexes that became fiveplexes, and there's even one in Pensauken that had the weirdest history of all of them. It opened in the 1960-67. It was the first Sam Eric theater, by the way. Sam Eric, it was this company that developed into through the 60s and into the 70s and bought out almost every theater in Philadelphia and a lot in the suburbs. But Sam Eric got its start in the 60s in Pensauken. It built a single 1,500-seat theater. One theater. In 1971, they built a second one, which was a 900-seat theater, a separate building. So it was on the same property, but there were these two separate theaters. One was called the Eric 1, the other was called the Eric 2. And then in the mid-70s, they subdivided the 1,500-seat theater into an 1,100-seat theater. Don't ask me how I remember all this stuff. And a 400-seat theater. And then they renamed what was the Eric number 2. They then called that the Eric 1. And the subdivided theater became number 2 and 3. So at this point, they had an 1,100-seat theater, a 900-seat theater, and a 400-seat theater. And then along came, I think it was 78, they built two new theaters and a central lobby that finally connected everything together. So now you had one very oddly shaped building, but it was a single building with a single lobby and four theaters. And I think those were, I believe they were 1,100, 400, 400, 700, and 900. I think it's something like that. And that was the Eric 5 Pensauken, and that stabilized for about 10 years, even longer than that. But then in the early 90s, the multiplexes, megaplexes, we were really at a time when five theaters was not enough. So I think it was in 92 they went and they subdivided the 1,100-seat theater and the 900-seat theater into four each. So they were left with, it became an 11-plex with one 700-seat theater and a bunch of, theaters that were anywhere from 200 to 400 seats. It was really kind of a mess. I enjoyed the Eric 5. The location was not great. It was, it's kind of a seedy area. But the theater itself, it had. I love the 5-plex. I saw, Die Hard there. I saw A Fish Called Wanda there.
Mm-hmm.
I saw many, many, many films there over the years. And even some of my early reviews were of films that I saw there. The last film I saw there was Gettysburg, and that was in the 700-seat theater. That was after it had been turned into an 11-plex. And that was actually the only time I was at the theater when it was an 11-plex. But it was a complete mess, architecturally and everything else. And eventually it closed down. But there you had a single-plex, a single movie theater that became an 11-plex over the course of its lifestyle. Well, now, I think we are at a point where it's going to go in the opposite direction. Where and you can't do this really well with a 24-plex. 24-plex, there are just too many screens. You can do some consolidation, but you're going to have to convert a 24-plex into anything else, multi-purpose auditorium, whatever you have planned for the site, tearing down one of the wings and building restaurants or what, it's going to require a lot of construction work. So obviously not going to be done right now in the middle of a pandemic. But, looking ahead 3, 4, 5 years down the road, theaters are going to really only, the only money in theater operation is going to be for blockbusters, for tentpoles. And it's going to be somewhat limited in terms of what you can even get out of that. So a 12-plex, for example, if such a thing exists, I'm sure they're probably there, might be able to scale back to like a being a six, having six auditoriums, combining auditoriums as opposed to, you know, subdividing them. I don't know. I mean, that might be too expensive to do.
Maybe.
But that's I think that anything new that's built would be look a whole lot different from what the theaters we're looking at today. So that movie theater in Hamilton is a white elephant. It's too big to be run as a standalone, as an independent theater. And certainly nobody in their right mind would buy it for another year or so.
Mm.
So my guess is that the plan is to raise it.
Really? You think they're going to tear the whole building down?
I think they have to tear the whole building down and probably build a housing development there or condominiums or something of the sort. It is a big enough piece of property that you can do that on. But it just, you know, who's going to buy it? Regal is not in a position where they could buy it, even if they were so inclined. And, you know, even with breaks, restructured leasing deal or something like that, no other, it's not a candidate for it to be run as an independent cinema. So, I mean, I think when they say it has closed for good, I think, you know, sometimes, you know, theaters, when they supposedly close for good, might open a few years later under a different name with a different. This, I think, is really truly closed for good.
So were you upset about that? I mean, again, maybe I'm just being a little emotional here. And like I said, it was sad and shocking to see that theater close, not just because of the memories, but because the theater seemed to be doing relatively well. I know these megaplexes, you know, they were in trouble. And let's just say for the sake of argument, we were in another dimension or another place where there was no pandemic. The theater probably would have been doing relatively well. Again, its location as compared to, say, some of the other megaplexes like, Franklin Mills or what have you. I always felt that this was one of those theaters that kind of served a pretty large area, and it drew people from so many different places. To see it go down, I mean, it's still sad. And what's interesting is that you emailed me when I notified you and said, look, this is just the first domino, right? We're going to see more in the next couple of weeks and months as well fall this way.
Well, AMC has actually closed a fair number of their theaters.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the six that they closed, Hamilton was one of those six, they closed others as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what you're seeing right now, and a lot of independent theaters have closed, I think across the United States, something along the line of close to 100 theaters have permanently closed this year. Obviously, this is because of COVID, but, you know, COVID is accelerating market trends that were already, you know, things that were already in process. And, you know, another thing that I don't think got reported particularly, I mean, I just saw something and I was like, wow. Universal Pictures signed a deal with
I did see that.
Mm-hmm. Cinemark, which is the number three. Yeah, in terms of U.S. Theater holdings, AMC is number one. Regal, which is actually owned by some something or other, they're number two, and Cinemark is number three. And I forget what number four is, but it's a fairly sizable drop down from Cinemark. I think if you look at the top three, their holdings are something like 60 to 70% of the houses in the United States are held between the three. Now, AMC already had a deal in place with Universal, but Cinemark now signed a deal, and the deal is that it changes the window between when a movie can, how long a movie can play in exclusively in theaters before it becomes eligible for either home video release or in particular video on demand or digital. And for movies that it's all based on the first weekend gross. So if your movie opens on this Friday, which is Friday, November 20th, and it makes less than $50 million, your window of exclusivity is 17 days. So that's basically 3 weekends, the weekend of the 20th, the weekend of the 27th, the weekend of December 4th. And then on Monday, December 7th, Universal could take the film to digital or release it on DVD just 18 days after or 17 days after its theatrical release. It can be available for home viewing. If the movie makes more than $50 million on its first weekend out, then they get to add 2 more weeks onto that, and it's a 30-day, 1 month window of exclusivity. So when Jurassic Park Dominion,
which opens, has wrapped, yes,
it has wrapped, but apparently it's now been pushed back to 2022. Hmm. And the argument for that is that although, Universal had an interesting comment about that. They said we could probably get it ready for its original June 2021 release date. But there are 2 reasons why we don't want to do that. One is we are not convinced that theaters are going to be back to normal by June, that we're still going to be dealing with smaller attendances than usual, which is true. I think that's absolutely true. And the second thing that they cited is that the 2021 marketplace is now oversaturated.
Mm.
And they do not believe that it's in the film's best interest to open next year, even though it will be ready to open next year. So when it opens in 2022, and it will make more than $50 million on its first weekend out, it will, it's due to open, I'm going to say like mid-June. I don't remember the exact date, mid-June. By mid-July, it'll be available video on demand.
Hmm.
Universal is the first studio to make these deals. It will not be the last one, because there's going to be, the other studios are going to see the benefits of doing this, and they're going to see the diminishing power of theater, of we'll call them bricks and mortar theaters, and they're going to want a piece of the pie. So this is going to be the norm pretty quickly. And that's effectively going to kill off a lot of movie theater business. So if you only have to wait a month to see a big movie, or 2.5 weeks to see a small movie at home, well, you're only going to go to a theater if, number one, you're just so impatient to see something that you can't wait the extra month. And, there was a time in my life when that might have been true of, Star Trek movies or, kind of fan-oriented films that have, big followings, people that are just, they want to see it. They want to have the experience of seeing it as soon as possible, first weekend out kind of thing. There are people like that, and there are movies that will cater to people like that. But the other thing is, what can a theater offer that you can't get at home? And we talked about this, I think it was in our last segment.
Yeah.
Kind of reshaping the theatrical experience, making it more visceral, making it more almost like an amusement park ride.
Mm-hmm.
And that offends some people. They say, well, it's not a movie anymore. Well, darn right it's not a movie anymore. That's no longer the point. The movie is what you're going to be watching at home. When you go out to a movie theater, you're not going out for a movie anymore. You're going for an experience. Prices will go up because, you know, you don't have the same level of attendance that you would have had for, you know, when you had a 24-plex and there are 24 movies playing, and, you know, most of the houses are at least a third to a half full. Those days are gone, never coming back again. Now you have to maximize what you can get, and that's focusing on tent poles. How many tent poles are released in a year? I'm going to say between 10 and 15.
Yeah.
You know, legitimate blockbusters. I don't see that number increasing because the amount of money and effort and time that's put into developing a blockbuster is such that you can't just start churning double that number out. What you have to do, what the studios will have to do, is work with each other to make sure that they're not, that there's spacing between them. If you have 12 blockbusters that come out a year, and you have a one-month window of exclusivity, wow, that just fits in very nicely, doesn't it? You release one a month around the year. But you got to find somebody that's willing to take January, February, and September, which are, I think, the weakest months for, you know, if you release beginning of month, you're not in great shape there. Those movies are going to suffer a little bit. But you have to space them out. You cannot have two blockbusters coming out in May, two in June, two in July, and then none in October and November. I mean, you have to space them out. Otherwise, you're going to kill the theaters because they're going to have, well, they won't care months when there are two blockbusters coming out. That'll be good for them. But if they then have to go 2 months without anything really new, their attendance is going to, I mean, the box office is going to fall apart. And, yeah, there are a whole lot of challenges here. And there's no way a 24-plex works in this new era. You know, maybe you devote a third of your screens, eight of your screens, to whatever the new blockbuster is. Well, unfortunately, you've still got 16 screens left. Well, let's see, maybe you even devote half of your screens. Well, now you're playing, you've done a lot of self-cannibalization there because you cannot fill 12 auditoriums, no matter how desirable the movie is. And what do you do with the other 12? Are you playing movies that maybe only have two people sitting there?
Right.
I mean, aren't you then spending more money on electricity and environmental stuff than what you're bringing in?
Well, that's the real question I had. After we had our conversation about 2 weeks ago, and actually over the last couple of months, I started thinking about this. One of the things that, look, it's common knowledge among people who attend movies on a consistent basis, but one of the things that allows theaters to survive is, or actually it is the primary reason they're able to survive, is the concession, right? The concession stands. Because they don't really get that much in the first couple of weeks of release. So my question is, if there were some kind of arrangement made to, you know, reduce the amount of concession price or reduce the concession prices to something that's really appealing to people to say, look, it's almost akin to what you'd see at a local maybe arcade or something, nothing that's really extravagant. Do you think that would add an extra incentive for people to actually not wait for a movie to be seen at home? Would they actually go and they say, listen, you know, I want that communal experience. I want to be around people. You know, cheap food, good presentation, is that enough? The question I have is that possible, number one? The second question, is that enough to bring people back? And then number three, is it the purview or is it under the control of the studios themselves to allow that to happen? Because obviously they're just looking at, okay, what's the best medium to get these films out there? And if they feel like, okay, look, we'll be better served at home, there's no reason for them to do that. So do you think concessions would have a role at all in maybe keeping the theater industry alive? Maybe these studios will say, look, we want this medium. these venues to survive. We will create a deal, or, you know, make the deal work in such a fashion that, look, the theaters don't have to rely so much on concession stands to survive. Or do you think that's just not going to happen?
Well, I think the issue with concessions is I don't think concessions in and of themselves are going to draw people back there.
Okay.
I think that if concessions are cheaper, you'll have people who are actually there either buying more or, you know, incentivized to buy where they might not have bought otherwise.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. What I think that they need, I mean, they need to take a page out of the, what I would consider to be the mall playbook. You know, malls, when they were originally built, were really shopping. I mean, they were shopping and shopping. I remember the Cherry Hill Mall back in the 70s. I'm not old enough to have remembered it when it first opened in the 60s, but I remember it in the 70s. So it was still relatively new at that point. I mean, the JCPenney wing,
yeah,
mm-hmm, had just been built the first time I went to Cherry Hill Mall, and that was called the new part of the mall. People who go to the mall today wouldn't have idea what I'm talking. I tell people I'll meet you in the new part of the mall.
Right.
New part of the mall. Yeah. So anyway. But in that era, there were no standalone. In fact, I stand corrected. There was one fast food restaurant. There was a McDonald's that was built as part of the new part of the mall. There was a McDonald's. It had seating in there. I don't know if it's still, maybe it's still there. Probably not. But the rest of it, you know, the department stores all had their own restaurants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you were actually going to eat in Bamberger's, for example, I'm dragging our name out of the real past here.
I'm not even familiar with them, to be honest with you. So.
You would get the Bamberger's at a restaurant in it. My grandmother used to say, let's go have hamburgers at Bamberger's.
Mm, okay.
So... You know, if you wanted to go to a mall, but you didn't go to a mall to eat. You went to a mall to shop. And if you were just, you know, you were there for the whole day, then maybe you stopped and ate in a department store. Those department store restaurants, by the way, were not cheap. Those were actually fairly expensive restaurants. But somebody got the idea. I'm going to say it was in the 80s. To add, you know, fast food establishments to it, they created something called the food court.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, I mean, more modern malls, you know, they didn't retrofit something. They were built with food courts in mind, and the food court then became a huge portion of the mall,
yeah,
and it pulled in business.
Oh yeah,
shopping was not as exciting as it had once been. So now the idea of food brought people in.
Mm.
Well, then in more recent years, a lot of the malls around here, you know, Cherry Hill and Moorestown in particular, Echelon has turned into something that's just sort of unspeakable.
Yes.
But Cherry Hill and Moorestown have put in upscale restaurants in the mall. And, you know, Capital Grill is in Cherry Hill.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of higher profile places in Moorestown. And the whole purpose of that was, okay, people don't really go to malls anymore to shop. But now, you know, we've created destination restaurants there. They will go to the restaurant and, yeah, maybe they'll just go to the restaurant and then leave, but maybe, you know, they'll be tempted to just walk around the mall when they're done with the restaurant. You know, if it's Christmas time, maybe they'll, you know, want to soak in the ambiance of, you know, see the decorations and stuff like that. So these restaurants became an important part of the mall's overall marketing. Now, there's no reason that movie theaters couldn't have the same approach.
That's a great idea, actually.
Now, I don't know whether you go you know, all in with trying to get like a 3 or 4 star restaurant, you know, into your multiplex or your megaplex, or whether you go for more of a food court approach. But you definitely bring in, you know, something other than what you've got now. Now, in a 24-plex, I mean, I've kind of sketched this out before. It's the average 24-plex is a double-wing building.
Yes.
One wing has got, one wing's got 12 theaters. The
12
other
and 12,
has 12,
right.
Theaters.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Hamilton, it was, I believe it was 10 theaters on either wing. And then they had a central hub that had some of their bigger theaters and off the central hub. But regardless, it's sort of almost built with so that you wouldn't have to alter the exterior structure in order to accommodate transforming one wing of the multiplex, the megaplex, into restaurants. Just the way in malls. Now, admittedly, there are some issues with the actual auditoriums themselves because they have sloped seats and stuff like that. So it would require a fair amount of internal work, but the walls themselves would not have to be changed. You'd have to do masonry, you'd have to do, you know, repurposing of all that stuff is doable. So you create, you know, restaurants or a food court or something that would... Now, a food court is probably not going to in and of itself pull people into a movie theater. But, you know, a few destination restaurants might. And then you've got the same dynamic that you have with the mall. There are people that are going to the restaurants just to go to the restaurants. They have no interest in seeing a movie. Okay, but now you've suddenly got more foot traffic there. The place just seems more alive. And then you've got people that are open to the idea of, hey, let's eat here. Let's then go over to the movie theater. And then you could have cross promotions. You could have a, you know, dinner and a movie package where you get along with your, you know, your 3-course meal or whatever, you get a couple of movie tickets to a specific showing at a specific time and place, and your meal is tied into that time. So your server is aware of when you have to leave. So everything is coordinated so that you will be able to make that movie. You can do all sorts of cross promotions. You know, somebody is going to think of this kind of thing. Well, the problem is that this costs money. It's not going to be cheap to convert a 24-plex into a 12-plex plus restaurants and, you know, maybe a combination of 2 or 3 destination restaurants and then a food court type thing for people who don't want to do an actual sit-down and they just want to grab a bite to eat before or after their movie. And then, I don't know, maybe you throw in a couple of retail establishments. And if you've been down to the Atlantic City casinos, that's kind of what, you know, at least the Borgata has. It's got an area with high-end restaurants. It's got some boutique shops. And then it's got the actual casino itself. And I don't necessarily suggest that you go in that because, you know, people are not going to be spending that kind of money there. But, you know, it's the same model. It's doable. It requires money to do it, though. And right now, anything related to a movie theater, they're just the money is not there.
Well, it's funny you bring that up because here's the interesting conundrum. And I think it actually kind of ties into everything. I was speaking to someone who used to work at AMC in a managerial capacity for over a decade. They're no longer there now. They've been away from that theater for quite some time. But they said that they're happy to see AMC in these trying times. They're happy to see the theater industry kind of in this situation because they want to see new blood injected into the theater exhibition industry. They want new investment. They want new investors. They want people who are willing to put money in. And in answer to your question about whether or not you can get that capital or get that money in, I would say yes, if you take the approach that you've suggested. I actually like that approach. I think it's a fascinating way to look at things, to have like either a food court approach a hub of restaurants and then make it an experience where people, you know, actually literally have a dinner and a movie, you know, because, you know, someone mentioned to me the other day, they said that if you are going to go out on a date with someone, it's better to, you know, go to the movies, then go out for dinner, not go to dinner and then go to the movies. Because if you go to see the movie first, then you have something to talk about the dinner, regardless of how bad the experience might be. So, that could actually fall into this. You know, you go to the theater, you watch a movie, and then you go to one of the food court areas or you go to the restaurants and you enjoy the experience talking, conversing, socializing afterwards. And I think that would be a very, very vibrant way to kind of build things up. Now, the present structure as is with AMC and with Cinemark and Regal, I just don't know if they have the capacity, because they would have to pretty much change their entire dynamic. They'd have to do something they've never done before. But if you had, say, a company like a Disney come in, and I'm not saying you want Disney to take over this, but maybe Universal, someone who's familiar with the theme park arrangements, coming in and making this kind of experience something that can be reproduced, I think it could be very successful, particularly because I do believe there's going to be this pent up, at least in the short term, desire to get back out again. I mean, one of the biggest challenges during COVID, I've been having this issue. I'm not trying to air my dirty laundry on the airwaves, but it's been trying to get my wife to not want to see her friends. Obviously, she's very careful and she, you know, social distances and all that, but she's getting antsy. She wants to get out. And I'm sure we all feel that way. We want to get out. You know, you and I, we consistently would go every week or two to Barnes and Noble and just kind of hang out, have coffee, have tea, and just talk for a couple hours. And it was great. We can talk on the phone, but that's just not the same. People are going to want this. And when you have this huge docket of films on the horizon that are being pushed back, and you have this pent-up desire, if someone is ambitious enough, and I'm talking about an investor outside third party, is ambitious enough and say, listen, we've got these buildings which are, you know, rife for exploitation. People are in trouble financially. It's almost like, you know, stealing from a carcass, so to speak, or a dying animal off the side of the road. You're saying, look, this is a chance for us to come in and really do something. My feeling is that this is a wonderful opportunity. As they say, whenever one door closes, another one opens. So I think that you will see people coming in. I think you're going to see different people coming in. But going back to what my friend said, he says it will actually make the industry healthier and better. What's your, you know, sense of all that? Do you think it will be better maybe? I mean, we've been talking in, you know, kind of depressing and sad terms, but let's face it, the industry needs change, and something like this may be that push it needed.
Yeah, there's still the exhibition industry is still working on a model that was essentially developed during the 1980s.
Right.
And that model worked very well for the 80s, for the 90s, for the 2000s. And then it started to run into some trouble in the 2010s. So even though the box office numbers have looked very impressive in the past years, I've done all these detailed number analyses and stuff like that, and it shows real cracks in the foundations. And you know, what happened was COVID was like a hurricane that came through and, you know, unleashed torrents of rain, and they all the water got down into those cracks in the foundations and widened them, and now everything's teetering. And you know, COVID essentially expedited the demise of the current model for exhibition, right, by at least 5 to 10 years. I mean, I do believe it's very predictable how this is going to go. That initially, we are going to see something of a rebound next year, not early in the year, but as you get into the year and more people have been vaccinated and mask wearing no longer is mandatory, and social distancing sort of kind of goes away, and people feel more comfortable about going out. This will probably be late in the summer when these things start to happen.
You're going to see an explosion.
People will want to go to movies, because
yes,
that's something that they did. That was, you know, that's a comfortable thing to do. But the if you look at the overall box office for 2021, it's still going to look very anemic compared to 2019.
Let me ask you this, as we head out, and again, I'm not trying to say that this is definitely going to be the case, and I'm not trying to tell you to predict certain things, but we are in the Philadelphia market, and obviously we have listeners from all over the country listening in, but I want to kind of hone in on Philadelphia. If you had to guess, now you said that there's going to be a big uptick in attendance in 2022. I agree with you 100%. You're going to see a surge towards the tail end next year as well. I agree with that as well. From now until that surge, that initial surge, we're going to see some rough patches, to say the least. Obviously, it's been very rough for the theater industry as a whole. If you had to guess, what theaters will we be seeing around by the start of this surge? I mean, in our area, so people who are listening, they'll say, okay, look, you know, I have, you know, some sense of where I'll be able to watch movies once they do start up again for real. You think Marlton will still be around? What about the Philadelphia market? I mean, King of Prussia is there. Where are people in Philadelphia going to be able to go to the movies, you think, when the surge begins again? What's the best place for them to go see movies, you think, once this...
Well, AMC Market Fair, which is a relatively new theater. That's the eightplex that's in the what used to be the Mark Gallery at Market East.
Mm-hmm.
That will still be there. That will still be operational.
Okay.
The Ritz 5, I believe that will probably remain operational simply because there are a lot of people in Society Hill that will support it. But I think the Ritz East might be done for.
Okay. And you think Voorhees is not going to make it, right?
Voorhees is not going to make it.
Okay.
Cherry Hill probably will make it because it's kind of like for a period. I mean, just mm-hmm. when the pandemic ends.
Right, that's what I mean. Yeah, I'm just talking about this initial, you know, I guess, like I said, uptick again, what will be around? Because from the, you know, sounds of things, maybe I'm just, like I said, kind of scarred by the whole Hamilton thing, but it really made it crystal clear that a lot of the places that we enjoy going to the movies, a lot of these places are going to be gone. They're just not going to be there when the theater industry is really going to want to get these films out there. So I'm wondering in this area, and it's really strange because I have not had this experience.
Well, you have to look at the demographics. The issue with Hamilton was most people, I mean, although it's, yeah, as you said, great location, not a lot of people just living around the corner from it.
True.
Hamilton drew probably from about a 10 to 15 mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
And it drew a lot of people in that had a, you know, small distance. It was more of a rural theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a strangely located one. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you don't see many. It was really a standalone theater
mm-hmm.
without, you know, anything connected to it or near it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cherry Hill, the one in Cherry Hill is a standalone theater, but it's across the road from a mall. The one in Morristown is attached to a mall.
Mm-hmm.
The one in Voorhees is part of a shopping center. So they have a, you know, the only, there's like a Pizzeria Uno is the only other thing in that,
right.
And I imagine that place is probably going to close now too, if it hasn't already.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, from a demographic standpoint, you can kind of understand that there might have been an attendance problem at Hamilton. I don't think you're really, I mean, everything around Cherry Hill, that AMC Cherry Hill, Lowe's Cherry Hill, whatever you want to call it, is congested.
Oh,
there are just a lot of people around there. And you're right on the edge of Pensauken and Camden and Philadelphia. You know, it has a lot of people to draw from, probably 10 to 15 times as many people as Hamilton had. So AMC will be looking at that, and they will say, okay, look, the numbers might not look great now, but as soon as we're past this,
exactly,
they should look good. Now, Cherry Hill is badly in need of some upgrading, but, you know, that can probably wait a little bit.
What about the Regal and Morristown Mall? You think that's going to be fine?
Yeah, it depends on what happens with Regal, but as long as Regal... As long as, number one, the mall stays open, which is always a question with Morris Town
right.
Hall.
Well, I guess in a nutshell, what you're saying is that the theaters that are likely to survive the next couple of months, the ones we're going to see when the uptick begins, are likely...
How about the next half year to three quarters of the year?
Yeah, okay. They are going to survive based on not necessarily what they can offer, but what's around the area that draws people in, is what you're saying. So it's almost like a microcosm of what you've been talking about with respect to having restaurants come in. It's kind of like what else is going to draw people to the theaters, just like the model you propose. So Cherry Hill, people are going to come in because high traffic. Marlton, people are going to come in because it's a good location and it's not going to cost them that much to kind of keep it going.
And it's also pretty high traffic.
It's pretty high traffic area as well. So that's what's going to be really the primary factor to determine whether or not they're going to continue. Places like Voorhees, not high traffic, in, you know, kind of an isolated location, so to speak. Deptford is the one I'm really curious about. That's the one I wonder about because, you know.
I think it's pretty, I mean, I don't know enough about Deptford because I almost never go over
right,
there.
Neither do I, right.
But I think it's relatively well attended. I don't think there's, I mean, not now, but I think in...
Now, is it still split into two portions across the highway the road? I remember there was...
No, those were actually two separate theaters.
Okay.
The AMC 8-plex is on one side. There was a GCC.
Okay.
That was at the mall proper.
Okay, okay.
Or on the mall property. That was the GCC Deptford 6, and that closed a number of years ago.
Oh, okay.
When GCC actually got bought out by AMC, and I think by the time that sale happened, that Deptford GCC had already closed. The only thing I remember ever seeing at that Deptford GCC is the Black Cauldron. That was 1985, so I can tell you it was open then. But you know, after that, I can't attest to anything. I also don't think that we should be too optimistic about the spring movie theater season.
Mm.
And I think that anybody who moved their movie out to March or April may be in a position where they have to move it again.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't... We may have some optimism by March and April that the vaccine is... Some people will have gotten the vaccine then, but I don't think enough people will have been inoculated for a complete sense of security to have resumed.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably when you'll get people saying, all right, we're ready to go back to the movies, that's probably going to be in, you know, the June, July time frame.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, movies that are that have been shifted into June and July and August might be okay, but even then there's going to be some softness to the market. If you want to bank on when movie theaters are really going to get the kind of surge that they need, it's probably about a year from now.
Mm.
Next October, November, December. I think we'll be taking the masks off in September.
Of next year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll be the social distancing will be going away. I think by next Thanksgiving, so about a year from now. A year from now, I think then we'll be really getting back to normal, and that includes starting to pack in movie theaters again. But between now and then, expect some real softness in the theater market and more shifts. And as I said, it looks like quite a few movies that currently reside in 2021 are going to end up in 2022. But I don't think anybody's going to be moving anything out of 2022.
Well, all I can say is we head out. We'll talk about this in the next couple of weeks. I think it's a fascinating discussion to have is where are these franchises going? And like you said, this multiverse approach to things allows for a redo. And I do believe, and this is the last point I'm going to make before we head out, I do believe that we will see another trilogy that takes place after Return of the Jedi that is more in line with what George wanted, whether it's an animated version, whether it's a hybrid, because again, what they've done on Mandalorian, it's amazing stuff. And the thing that's really great about that show is that it focuses on the aliens. It focuses on the exotic locations. It's got great action. And ultimately, in the end, I understand the Jedi and the mythology is so important. That's what makes it, you know, very different from everything else. That's what people wanted in these films. And they wanted the original series to be honored. And Dave Filoni and, John Favreau have done an amazing job here, an incredibly respectful job. And I think that that's the approach that they have seen. And I'm talking about Disney, that has resonated the strongest with fans. So, James, we'll talk in 2 weeks about that. And like I said, it's fun when we have these kind of free-flowing discussions. And like I said, we'll kind of talk about these franchises and see where we can go with them. And, you know, maybe they'll listen and kind of take some of our advice as well.
Okay.